first sat down feeling very happy to be amongst you all and feeling how I'm getting to know some of you, and we've gone, it was wonderful to go on a hike and get to know some more of you a little bit better. And I think somehow slowly as a Sangha we're sharing our lives together. Our more personal life naturally I think overlaps a little bit, but certainly overlaps a lot with our practice life, and our practice overlaps with our Sangha life. And as we but part of our personal lives is all kinds of changes, and there's a lot of depth and a lot of pain and sadness in the changes. And so one of the things that happened was that Judy Morse, who was in our Sangha for not so very long, but kind of jumped in very wholeheartedly. She died 2 weeks ago yesterday. And I mentioned that she was sick about 2 months ago, it seems, 3 months ago. And then she was given 2 weeks to live. And she lived for another couple of months. And one of the regrets she had, she said, was that she didn't start meditation practice earlier in her life. And it was only in the last 9 months of her life, I think, that she really had discovered us in our practice. And I visited her a couple of times at home. She was a very private person. And I visited her, she was laying in bed. And I had a sense that in her last months, that her staying at home and being in bed, that was, for her, kind of intensive experience of meditation. She was kind of regretting she couldn't meditate much anymore, but I think when you're in that state of being on your deathbed, preparing for death, that it becomes a practice in its own right. And first time I talked to her, I had a sense that she was, that her whole, that some of the last 20 years of her life, she was trying to come to some kind of peace with herself. And that the last piece of it was this last 2 months she had of her life. And it's hard to know, but the feeling I had was that she didn't die after 2 weeks, because she had still things to take care of and coming to some kind of peace or at ease with herself. And so mostly she stayed, I think, in her room by herself and didn't have a lot of visitors. Some of us here from the Sangha visited her, but the feeling was kind of she wanted to be alone. And mostly she seemed pretty much at ease with her dying. And she wrote she talked to Marcia, who's in our group here, it's a friend of hers. And she talked to Marcia on the phone once, and Marcia wrote me a note. And Judy had told Marcia that she couldn't understand what she was doing all her life, making all those lists. That somehow when you're on your deathbed, you see your life in a different perspective, what's important and not important. And I was very touched and moved by how I felt she was engaged with her life and her dying in her last couple of months, at least two times I saw her and the times I talked to her on the phone. And I made it clear to her that I would come and see her any time, day or night, that she wanted to me to see her. But I didn't want to come unless I was invited, because she felt like such a private person. And she never called. And then about 4 or 5 days before she died, I had this overwhelming feeling that I should go anyway. And so I went and saw her, and she was very glad to see me. And she said she wanted to see me again, and I told her again that she had to call me and invite me. And she didn't do it. She died. I saw her, I think, on a Thursday, and she died on Tuesday. And she had, apparently, she had some bouts of fear and anger on and off as she approached her death. And I felt, even though she was working so well, done so much in preparing herself or coming at peace with herself, I felt, and I'm not one to judge, I didn't know her that well, but my feeling was that the parts of her character, personality, that she kept at arm's distance. And every once in a while, I think as you're dying, sometimes it's hard to keep them at a distance. And so every once in a while, they'd surface and they'd come out as anger and fear. But mostly, she seemed very much at ease. It was quite remarkable. It was a first person, one of the first people. I guess there's been a couple of other people, but since Howard's death, Howard Noodleman, who started the Sangha and was its mentor for many years, since the time of his death, Judy has been the person I felt who has most kind of died within the Sangha, most clearly. And And as we deepen as a Sangha and a practice community, that'll be more of our experience, that some of us will die. And some of us will give birth, and some of us will get married. And so on Saturday, I married Adam, who many of you know. Adam is a big part of our group, and he's one of the people who regularly kind of comes early and sets up for us so we can sit here, and stays late and puts the chairs back, and he's been very committed. And so he was married. I married him with Denise, who doesn't come much, I think. But that was a very happy ceremony, and it was very nice to do. And I felt there was a lot of care and attention that they put into preparing for their marriage and their wedding, and it felt like a privilege. I felt like they were marrying each other. I was just kind of there, point the finger, or I don't know what, giving them an excuse to marry themselves. What I wanted to talk about this tonight, which was a bit on my mind, is the subject of gratitude. And I have a way of beginning the talk that I wrote down, but somehow I don't feel so connected to the beginning of my notes anymore. So that's a little bit awkward position to be in. But I'll start there anyway. I was traveling in Asia. At some point I had my traveler's check stolen in Calcutta. And I went back to visit Munindra, who was living in Calcutta, who's a fairly well-known Vipassana teacher, and I was visiting, staying at his temple. And I went back and explained to him that all my traveler's checks had been stolen. And he looked at me and said, it's very important to be simple, but you mustn't be a simpleton. And then I remember this line in T.S. Eliot's poem, The Four Quartets, where he says, a state of complete simplicity, costing nothing less than everything. Is that how it is, the line? Got it? A state of complete simplicity, costing nothing less than everything. And I think that Vipassana practice can be understood as something very simple, and various ways of understanding simplicity or being simple. And one way is just the practice itself is simple. That and one of the things that teachers often do with their students is to encourage them to be simple about the practice. Don't make the practice complicated. Stay simple. And sometimes the way that we give the instructions, it sounds like there's all the stuff to remember. You know, mindfulness of the body, of the breath, of feelings, of emotions, of thoughts and intentions, and it just goes on and on. And, you know, what are you supposed to pay attention to next? And you start having checklists to make. And so teachers have to say, please, you know, keep it really simple. The practice is very simple. It's just mostly being aware of what's happening right in front of us and being present with what's happening as it's happening and remaining somewhat uncomplicated about what's happening. And part of our suffering and part of the difficulty of our life is the way in which we complicate what is happening. We complicate it usually by chain of associated thinking that involves judgment and evaluation and criticism and more and more elaborations. And we're trying to do in Vipassana is not to deny anything at all. Nothing's to be denied. But can we have an uncomplicated relationship to whatever it is that arises in our experience? To be, in some sense, simple. And this is closely connected, I believe, to the idea of being grounded in our experience. I like the word being grounded because it's being connected to what is tangible in our experience. And to kind of to stay in touch with what's tangible, of feeling solidly here, of connecting to the ground we are, or the body we're in. And the opposite of being grounded, of having an uncomplicated presence, is being spaced out or spacey, perhaps, of floating in the air above the earth, and And how I understand floating in space or floating in the air, kind of being ungrounded, is being lost or living in or living through or within the world of abstract stories, distant stories, unconnected to what's really happening in the moment or happening in front of us. And this could be a kind of chain of concepts, web of concepts that the mind spins out, and then we get spun into and get lost within. And this spinning of conceptual and abstract thoughts is called, Pali, is called papancha. It's a somewhat important Pali word, so I introduce that to you, one word, maybe one word a week. Papancha is the word. And you see many different translations into English for what this means, but I understand it to be the proliferation of ungrounded thoughts. Proliferation of thoughts that are not really connected to anything that's particularly real or grounded. And such things I talk about, I've talked about that in the past. So there's a kind of simplicity in the practice itself, of trying to be simple, to see things directly as they are. But also in the practice, there's a possibility of simplicity of identity, having a simple identity, simple self-identity, a self-identity that's not really complicated. And so much of this, our sense of self, our image of self, our way we present ourselves to ourselves, is tied into this world of papancha, this world of abstract and associated thinking, abstract thinking, that has no connection with much at all. And learning to ground ourselves in actually what's actually happening in the present moment is a way of finding a truer identity than the identity some of us are lost in, when we're kind of lost in fantasies about our life and who we are and what we want and what we should have. And I'm just thinking right now this famous story of Mullah Nasruddin, who, I can't remember now, you remember looking for the perfect woman? Mm-hmm. Do someone know it? How does it go? Anyway.
Something about, he's always looking for the perfect woman and somebody who's spoiled, but she's not at home in the world or something like that, so he moves somewhere else and goes to a number of different women, and there's always something wrong with each one of them. He finally gets to the one. She was perfect in every way. She was beautiful and sensual and world. And he says, "Well, did you marry her?" And he says, "No, she was looking for the perfect man."
So to have a simple identity is to have an identity which is not spinning out fantasies about who we are or what we want or what we should get. And not only is this world of papancha often unnecessary, but it often gets in our way of really seeing what's directly in front of us. There is in the sutras, in the Buddha sutras, various teachings about if you think that you're enlightened, you're not enlightened. And it's a little bit different than the Taoist thing, the Taoist teaching that if you speak about the Tao, you don't understand it. It's a little bit different. But if you think you're enlightened, you're not. And the way I understand it is that it's more like rather than focusing on people who are enlightened, like someone's enlightened and now I'm enlightened and that's it. It's more like there are states of enlightenment, periods of enlightenment. And when you're fully awakened, fully present for life as it is, I believe in that state, there is no possibility of being self-reflective about the status of that state, about, oh, now I am awakened. You might think later on, oh, I was awakened. And then you might say, well, now I am an awakened person because I was yesterday. So you have that prerogative to do that, But technically, if you think of your awakened or enlightened person, then you're not. An awakening has a freshness and an openness in it that maybe doesn't allow for that level of self-reflectivity. there's such a strong feeling, I think, of individualism or we getting something or wanting something, that the notion that enlightenment's not going to happen to you, it might happen, but not to you, is kind of either confusing or frightening or discouraging. Full awakening is something, and it happens to people, or happens, but doesn't happen to you. And maybe it's a state of complete simplicity, being very simple. And I think that's what the practice is in part about, allowing yourself to become simple, allowing yourself to be as you are without any need to prove yourself, defend yourself, or try to be something else than you are. When you are as you are, you're not looking for something else or looking to be something else. Simply becoming aware of our moment-to-moment existence, being aware of how we think, what we're thinking, how we act, what we're acting, what we see, what we touch, what we smell. And within this simplicity of identity, the simplicity of being, of presence, there is a rich world of spirituality that flowers. And so some people might not feel that simplicity or being simple is very interesting because maybe it's boring. And maybe you have to go through a period of boredom. I think a lot of people, not everyone, but a lot of people who do spiritual practices discover a time when they feel they don't necessarily feel bored, but there's something boring about the practice. It doesn't seem to have much in it. But in that simplicity, maybe sometimes that boredom, is a possibility of something else being born, something else to flower. And it's often a very rich world of spirituality. And I'm struck over and over again by, first, the simplicity of sitting practice itself, of meditation practice, but how in the sitting practice, you discover a state of being that requires nothing, doesn't seem to require anything, where you're kind of completely present and fully alive and fully content, fully present, awake, open. And it doesn't seem to be conditioned by whether someone loves you or doesn't love you, or whether you have enough food, or you have enough money, or have a good job, or have the right spouse, or have the right car, or whatever it might be that usually maybe defines a little bit how we're happy or not happy. That it's possible to leave ourselves alone so thoroughly and stop the spinning up a pancha, and we'll discover this simplicity in which it feels dynamically and vitally kind of alive and full and present, and it's fantastic. And it's what T.S. Eliot says, it's a state of complete simplicity costing nothing less than everything. You give everything up and something wonderful flowers within you. And part of the value, I think, of such states is realizing it's possible to be completely at home with oneself and at home in the world without anything propping you up, without anything supporting you. And having a taste of that, sensing that possibility, allows us, I believe, to walk through our life, walk through a normal life, walk through our jobs and our family life and everything with a slightly different perspective than we would if we didn't have that. Because if we don't have that perspective, seeing that it's possible to be happy and at home with oneself, requiring nothing, then we go around requiring other things in order to make ourselves happy. And as I said, you're setting yourself up for potential suffering and stress if you require a lot from the external world in order to make you happy. And if we're not actively imposing ourselves or our ideas or our control on the world around us, then there's the possibility of having a sense of participating in an interactive reality. I think part of the beautiful flowering of spirituality that happens when you're so simple that you require nothing is you begin feeling that you're living in a world that's interactive with you. That there isn't something, you know, the world isn't out there, some kind of blank material or distant thing, or you're here as a separate entity. But what reality is interactive with who you are. And I don't know how, I don't want to define what that interaction is. Because it's partly because you start dangerously going into metaphysics, maybe, if you do that. But I think much of what we call religion in the world comes, in many of its forms, arises in part from our sense of participating in an interactive reality, and in part from trying to explain the nature of that interaction. And I suspect that some people who talk about God, what they're referring to as God is some kind of, that actually what they're experiencing and interpreting is some sense of being in an interactive reality, and maybe anthropomorphizing that interactive quality of nature of reality. Or as a Zen poem says, ultimate reality responds to the inquiring impulse. That if you go into reality with an inquiring impulse, with a sense of mindful inquiry, that the world responds to that. The reality responds in some way to that impulse to inquire. One of the powerful emotions that can flower within one, a person who discovers some state of simplicity, of simple presence, and from sensing maybe this interactive presence, interactive nature part of reality, is a sense of gratitude. And gratitude is one of the beautiful movements and feelings of the heart. And I believe for myself, in my own way, I've experienced it, that learning that you require nothing, in a sense, gives birth to a tremendous sense of gratitude for the world we live in. And the experience of awakening to reality and to life, both in having small awakenings, which we all have regularly, and maybe sometimes we don't even recognize we're having it, and then also larger kinds of awakenings, these kinds of awakenings are often often experienced together with feelings of gratitude. Remember that in some of the stories of the Buddha's life, it says that after he was awakened under the Bodhi tree, he spent 7 days, he kind of stood away from the tree, and he spent 7 days gazing in gratitude at the tree that he sat under on his night of his enlightenment. I think it's a beautiful story to this feeling of gratitude that the Buddha had towards the tree. And we can ask ourselves, you know, what does a tree symbolize? Does it symbolize the earth or nature or the something, you know? What is it it symbolizes? It maybe doesn't symbolize anything, but the Buddha, one part of his response or part of what he had experienced in his enlightenment was tremendous gratitude. And to stand there for 7 days in gratitude, that's pretty, pretty good. And I've told this story a few times over the years, but it's kind of a cute story in that I'm, you know, a graduate student in religious studies, so I take a lot of classes in religious studies. But my undergraduate degree was in agriculture, and took classes in botany. And my botany classes were much more religious than any of my religious studies classes. And I used to leave my introduction to botany class in awe of how nature plants worked, and in awe of the cycling of nutrients in the environment. And I'd go out and I'd literally leave the class and look at the trees outside the quad at the university, and just be in utter kind of awe and in gratitude at nature and these trees, and thinking about kind of how, where did I start and where do I begin? Because my life depends on these plants creating oxygen, and maybe in some sense they depend on me creating carbon dioxide. And, you know, I can maybe do without one of my lungs, I can do without a kidney, but I can't do that without the plants out there. If I can't do without the plants out there, where do I begin, where do I end? And I used to go out, just stand there and look at trees and just feel tremendous awe. And I don't think it's too surprising that one has gratitude upon some kind of awakening, because awakening or enlightenment or a sense of being at home with oneself is usually experienced as a gift or something that's freely given. If many people will talk about this, and where does it come from? Suddenly you feel tremendous peace or tremendous opening or sense of being at home in the world, or awakening, or sense of presence, and you don't know, you know, where did that come from? You know, you huff and puff and follow your breath, and that's what caused it. You know, you've huffed and puffed for a long time and nothing happened. And suddenly, you know, and who knows from one day to the next, you sit down and you don't expect anything to happen. You sit down and you feel different. Something different happens. And it's a gift. Who knows what it is? And everything's a gift. Our whole experience is a gift. So it makes sense to feel gratitude when you feel that your life is a gift. This is a quote from Gary Snyder's book, The Real Work. So he's a poet who, I finished off the trail crew season and went on a long mountain meditation walk for 10 days across some wilderness. During that process, thinking about things in my life, I just dropped poetry. I don't want to sound precious, but in some sense I did drop it. Then I started writing poems that were better. From that time forward, I always looked on the poems I wrote as gifts. They were not essential to my life. If I never wrote another one, it wouldn't be a great tragedy. Ever since, every poem I've written has been like a surprise. You get a good poem and you don't know where it came from. Did I say that? And so all you feel is, you feel humility and you feel gratitude. And you'd feel a little uncomfortable, I think, if you capitalized too much on that without admitting at some point that you got it from the muse, or whoever, or whatever, or however. So who knows where our spirituality comes from, our sense of being connected to ourselves. It's always there. Many of the kind of experiences we can have, and I should say maybe Vipassana has nothing to do with experiences, so you don't kind of go thinking of experiences where it's at, so that's what I'm talking about now. But in any case, so many of the experiences of calm or unity or awakening or peace can feel that they come as gifts. And then we also quickly forget that they are gifts. And when we forget that they're gifts, then we begin striving after them, hoping to re-experience them, to recreate them. And so many people will have some kind of wonderful experience in meditation or in their life, and will spend years chasing after it again to have it again, and they end up with headaches if they're lucky, or making themselves miserable chasing after some experience. And sometimes these experiences are not so significant, but you think they are. I don't know why you think they are, but sometimes people have dramatic, you know, big bursts of white light. And they've never seen so much white light in their life. Like, you know, supernova explodes in front of them. Wow! And then they want that again. They spend 2, 3, 4, 5 years trying to have white explosions of white supernovas, without ever asking themselves what the value is of having supernovas explode in front of you. People have experiences of white light. Remember that it's a gift, and I think. We have a different kind of relationship to it. And I think certainly with gratitude, you feel a sense of gratitude towards these gifts, or to the gift of life. Then I think in some maybe paradoxical sense, we're actually more open in experiencing this again, to feel at home with ourselves, to be comfortable with ourselves, and then be grateful for that. That state of gratitude is close to a state of being open and letting it possible to happen again. And you can't construct that kind of gratitude, but you can be open to it, or I don't know. And certainly with gratitude, we are more comfortable with ourselves. And the focus of our attention no longer becomes exclusively on ourselves or self-preoccupied. I think the experience or state of gratitude is one where we're not so self-centered. And being self-centered sometimes is a source of tremendous suffering. And sometimes I feel that the American philosophy of individualism, which is so important in our culture, leaves very little room for gratitude. Many of us tend to be resentfully demand what is our right, rather than recognize the giftedness of life. And individualism often, I feel, comes with demanding what's your right. And I don't know if that's a good way of going through life. Maybe it's necessary to some degree, but... And it struck me in thinking about this today that the more complex and technologically sophisticated our society becomes, the more dependent we become on other people and others. And yet, rather than feeling increasing gratitude that all these people are working hard and creating this wonderful world that takes care of us, the feeling I have, and that could be wrong, but my impression is we're ending up being more and more resentful and more and more demanding and less appreciative of all that holds us up, holds our life together. We expect and we demand and it's our right to have the trains come on time, the telephone to work, and you know, all these things. And it should be the opposite. The more complicated, the more we realize there's a wonderful interconnectedness, inter-supporting kind of network that makes up our life. Shouldn't we feel increasing gratitude to all the work and all the people who make it possible? In the old days, when people felt much more that their life depended on nature and farming or whatever, there was often, I think, a feeling of gratitude. It was much easier. But now that it's people who hold up our life, or much more than they used to, I think it's harder to feel the gratitude. Maybe part of that reason is that maybe many of us in our works do our works, we don't do our work in a state of as a generous act. That we do our work as just kind of rote work, or we're just, I don't know, just making a living, trying to get by, or being ambitious, or there isn't a kind of generous spirit in the way in which we work, that or even the sense that this work that I'm doing is supporting society. Or, you know, I'm just going to do my work and get as much money as I can. And if the work is done in that attitude, maybe then it's hard, then it's easy to understand why the people who receive that work then don't feel a lot of gratitude. Lately, I've been feeling a lot of gratitude towards the public officials in Woodside, where I live now, up in Skyline, because maybe that's the public officials of Woodside, but it's so impressive. These people, these Caltrans people, I mean, it seems like they're up there on Skyline and up on 84, just nonstop, just ready to take care of the mudslides, and there's mudslides all the time now. And I just, day and night, they're up there and working hard, and so, you know, it's just amazing. It seems like it's way beyond the call of duty. And then I live right up the street from where those two kids were lost last week. And they're like one of them, maybe, I don't know, if our closest neighbor, but maybe, I don't know how the woods work. And I was so impressed by how much the people of Woodside and the police and everything really were trying their best, really working hard. I felt it was a gift way beyond what their job required. I'm getting sidetracked. And it's humbling to consider how much we're dependent on the efforts of others. Thinking also, what's the difference between saying that someone has a gift and saying that someone has an ability? Or saying that I myself have a gift, as opposed to saying I have an ability. And my sense is that the difference is that to say that someone or I have a gift is that it's something that's given to you, that's not really your own. It's not something that you can kind of claim for yourself. Whereas if you say you have an ability, then you can kind of claim it and have an ego around it. But it's more difficult maybe to have ego around a feeling of having a gift and being gifted. And everybody has a gift or many gifts, and taking delight in our gifts is certainly been part of the Buddhist tradition, and I think the impression I have, it's been part also of the Christian tradition at times. I think it's the Christians who came up with the idea of having a gift. So gratitude is a big part of my own practice, in my own Buddhist meditation practice, mindfulness practice, and I often feel very grateful at the end of my sitting or during my sitting, and it's not gratitude towards anything in particular. I can't often kind of say, you know, if someone asks me, what are you grateful for, and it's just, I'm just grateful for life, or grateful for just grateful. It's enough just to say that. Thankful. And I'm very fond of bowing at the end of a sitting like this. I don't do it as a teacher because I don't want to... I somehow feel like I shouldn't do that that kind of ritual for people, for you all. Kind of. Some of you do it, but I don't want to set... If I do it, then it becomes like maybe everybody should do it. And but just, you know, feeling it kind of expresses. It's nice sometimes to express what you feel and to express the gratitude. There's a gratitude that I feel towards many people, specific people and people in general. And certainly I feel a lot of gratitude towards my teachers, the many teachers I had, I have and still have, who have given me so much and inspired me in so many ways. And I read some time ago that all wisdom is plagiarism. Only foolishness is original. So I have a great gratitude to my teachers. And I have a great gratitude towards all the people who supported me in my practice. So many people have supported me. Even today, people still support me. You support me. Many people support me, allowing me to practice. And I felt it really strongly when I was in Asia, and especially in Burma, where I was a guest of the state, it felt like, and all these resources, all these people were making it possible for me to practice. And I felt so grateful for people giving me food and clothing and medicine and lodging and teaching and all these things. And people didn't have much money. They really wanted to support me because I was practicing. And out of that sense of gratitude towards those people came a kind of great inspiration to practice better or more thoroughly or more consistently, or not to kind of be lazy, or not to kind of take a, you know, whatever, because I felt all this gratitude. And as my response to that gratitude, I just really wanted to practice well. And a big part, a part of the motivation I have to teach is in some way to arises out, I don't want to say repay the gratitude, I don't know if that's the right word, but a big part of the reason I teach arises out of a sense of gratitude. And gratitude for my teachers, gratitude for the practice, gratitude for everyone else, and wanting them to share that, share or come, or to come from, to express that gratitude. Gary Snyder walked across the wilderness for 10 days and found that he didn't have to write poems anymore. So I think, you know, we sit and we discover our lives through mindfulness. And it's a process of discovery, discovering our lives, discovering the world. And the process of discovery, sometimes we discover the beauty, the marvel, the wonder of how little we actually need. We don't need to make our poems. We don't need to. What do we need? What don't we need? And maybe we realize how little we actually need. Get the response is a tremendous feeling of gratitude. So I hope that my talking about gratitude resonates with some of you and your experiences. And it doesn't, I hope it doesn't discourage you, because that's okay. And but I think that's my own personal sense. Yes, Elaine.
I found our teachers silent about receiving, or at least it's better to give than to receive, has gotten in the way of our being able to receive and therefore have gratitude. And for my part, I find that if I can be more conscious of receiving all the time and how much I'm receiving, and isn't this wonderful for me to be receiving this?
Oh, yeah, beautiful. Well, I think we're constantly the recipients of a lot. And I think part of spirituality is to realize that we're being gifted, we're being given, probably all the time. A tremendous amount. And this kind of the giving that we get from our friends or something is a lot easier to receive if you realize that most of your life is a gift. The air we breathe is a gift, and the water, the food. So many cultures, so many religions have... why is it called grace at meal? Why do we use the word grace? Because it's grace kind of means, comes from root to of something free, right? Why do we say grace? What's the word grace? What is it? Why do we use the word grace for the benediction or blessing or thank you? At
maybe it's the same as gracias.
Maybe that's probably it. Mm-hmm. So like gratitude also means like grateful, and yeah, maybe that's it. But in Buddhism also, they have various chants they say before a meal. One of them is that they use at the Zen Center. Innumerable labors brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us. Receiving this offering, it's nice. Receiving this offering, the food we receive is an offering to us. Receiving this offering, we should consider whether our virtue and practice deserve it. Desiring the natural order of mind, we should be free from greed, hate, and delusion. We eat this food and awaken with everyone. Be able to receive, and part of not feeling comfortable with receiving, and I think the dynamic you're pointing out to me, Elaine, is a very important one. And some of what's going on is a kind of prevailing sense of many people in our culture that we're somehow unworthy of receiving, that it's not okay to receive, not okay to have to be a gifted person, not okay to have virtues or do good deeds or feel good about yourself or whatever. And that exploring the roots and understanding the dynamics of unworthiness, it will go help you a long way to opening up to being willing to receive and be in the receiving end. Last question. Yeah. Or comment.
Chogram Trungpa said that grace is...
Patience is a virtue. Virtue is a grace. Grace is a little girl with a dirty face.
But you must have got it from there. I haven't heard of that.
I learned that from my Norwegian grandfather. He probably learned it in England when he lived in England in the 1920s. But grace is one of these wonderful English words that is at the intersection between the spiritual and the physical. Because we talk about grace, receiving grace from God or a spiritual or something, or being in a state of grace. And also, someone moves with grace. And, you know, what is it? And there can be a sense of physical grace and spiritual grace. And maybe there's an intersection or they meet someplace. And if grace also means gratitude or thankfulness, so much the better for the word. It's a great word. Probably patience, maybe it's a little bit of it.
There's a painting of the three graces also.
What look like?
I don't know what they represent.
A copy, bring it next week. Okay, so thank you all.